I gave no thought to wisdom. It all but vanished in the haze. Oh, this fragile hand of fortune had changed and turned it all to gray. Oh, in secret rooms where we can spy the very streets we walked along, the desert heat became a fire, and no idea where we belong. Now every day I fall apart, the sky is full of emptiness. I take the blame, the burning heart, it brings me down, I must confess. Now every day I fall apart, the sky is full of emptiness. I take the blame.
Broadcasting from Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan, this is WHFR, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local, alternative, and independent artists.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Let's call it what it is. These people are domestic terrorists. And the law should reflect that, and they should be punished as if it was an act of terrorism.
A man accused of stabbing five Jewish worshippers during a Hanukkah celebration at a rabbi's home in New York has been charged with hate crimes, as police say he kept journals and references to Adolf Hitler and Nazi culture. His family and lawyers say he's mentally ill. In Texas, the man who shot and killed two people at a church in White Settlement had a long criminal history of arrests for assault, battery, and theft. He was shot dead by an armed parishioner. This comes as a new Associated Press database counts more mass killings in 2019 than any year in over half a century. We'll get response from Audrey Sasson, Executive Director of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, and reporter Alex Yablon. Then, Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World.
Documented immigrants, the people that he is targeting are people who are so deeply embedded in the fabric of this country.
The obstacle is systemic. It's systemic. It's a system that's been set up in a certain way. Times have changed, ideas have matured, and the system might not have caught up with that or stayed up with that.
Ava DuVernay, Ai Jen Poo, just some of the women featured in the new memoir by media legend Pat Mitchell, called Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World.
I found on the front lines in the Middle East, in Northern Ireland, in El Salvador during the wars, I found women who were bridging their political differences, coming from different sides of these long-term conflicts, and finding ways to shape solutions to end the violence in their communities.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, thousands of people are protesting outside the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad after a slew of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria killed at least 24 members of an Iranian-backed militia Sunday. The protesters and militia members marched on Baghdad's heavily guarded green zone and demanded the United States withdraw all troops from Iraq. The U.S. Embassy has been evacuated. In a tweet this morning, President Trump blamed Iran for orchestrating the protests outside the U.S. embassy. But Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdelmehdi said he warned the United States not to carry out the airstrikes, but that his warning was ignored.
The U.S. defense minister told me that the U.S. would carry out attacks on bases of Qatib Hezbollah, and this would take place after a few hours. I told him this is a dangerous matter and would escalate tension, and we should discuss such affairs.
The U.S. airstrikes came after an American contractor was killed in a rocket attack in Kirkuk, Iraq, Friday. The United States has around 5,000 troops stationed in Iraq, as well as an undisclosed number of civilian contractors. Prosecutors have filed federal hate crimes charges against a man accused of stabbing five Jewish worshipers during a Hanukkah gathering at a rabbi's home in Muncie, New York, Saturday evening. Officials say they discovered anti-Semitic writing, references to Hitler and swastikas in the journal of the suspect, Grafton Thomas. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has condemned the attack as domestic terrorism. Thomas's friends and lawyers say his client is mentally ill.
My impression from speaking with him is that needs serious psychiatric evaluation, and that is the primary focus. I don't know whether those who are making these charges have spent a moment speaking with him or relating to him, but my impression from what I have read in my conversation with him is that there are severe psychiatric issues.
In Texas, identified the gunman who opened fire in the middle of a Sunday church service in White Settlement, Texas, outside Fort Worth. Authorities say Keith Thomas Kinyonen had a long criminal history that included arrests for assault, battery, and theft. He was killed by armed parishioners after fatally shooting two worshipers, 64-year-old Anton Wallace and 67-year-old Richard White. We'll have more on the attack at the West Freeway Church of Christ and at the rabbi's home in Muncie, New York, after headlines. The New York Times has revealed the details of a previously unreported Oval Office meeting between President Trump and Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and then National Security Advisor John Bolton, where the three high-level officials tried to convince Trump to release U.S. military aid to Ukraine. The meeting in late August failed to convince Trump to release the aid, which was being withheld to pressure the Ukrainian president to investigate Trump's political rival, Joe Biden, ahead of the 2020 election. The House has impeached President Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress after an inquiry centered on the decision to withhold the nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine. In India, the death toll amidst the government's crackdown on widespread protests has risen to at least 27 people, with over 1,000 more arrested. Demonstrators are protesting against the controversial new citizenship law, which provides a path to Indian citizenship for undocumented immigrants from Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, unless they're Muslim. The law's critics say it's a step toward the official marginalization of India's 200 million Muslims. This is the chief minister of West Bengal, Mamata Banerjee.
We won't let them kick anyone out. This is our promise. Center can make laws, but who implements it? States do. Center has no authority here. How will they implement the law here? If you see in India, 90% of states are in the hands of their opposition parties, not in the hands of the BJP.
Meanwhile, in Kashmir, the Indian government has released five Kashmiri political leaders after nearly 5 months in detention. But Kashmir's three most prominent leaders remain detained, and the Indian-occupied territory remains on lockdown. There's been no internet access for nearly 5 months, marking the longest internet blackout ever imposed on a democracy. In Sudan, a court has sentenced 29 intelligence officers to death for the torture and killing of Ahmad Al-Khair, a teacher who was arrested for participating in protests against the longtime leader Omar al-Bashir. Sudanese security forces killed at least 170 people in the crackdown against the massive uprising, which ultimately toppled Bashir in April. This is a protester speaking after Monday's sentencing.
The Sudanese judiciary proved today without a doubt its integrity and value. We hope it continues on the same path in all cases. As teachers, the rulings have cooled our fires. We hope the rest of the criminals who caused the widowing of women and orphaning of children are captured.
In Australia, 4,000 people were forced to flee to the beach as deadly wildfires scorched the southeast of the country Tuesday. Mallacoota residents were trapped between the ocean and advancing flames as smoke turned the morning sky black. The death toll from the fires rose to 12 after a father and son in the region died fighting the fires. Climate change-fueled fires in Australia have killed nearly 500 million animals and blanketed Australia in smoke. Climate activists and scientists are pointing to Australia as an example of what's to come in the decades ahead if radical steps aren't taken to curb global carbon emissions. This comes as the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney warned the world is on track to warm nearly 4 degrees Celsius and urge financial institutions to stop financing companies that fuel climate change.
He's talked about 2020 being a decade of action absolutely necessary on climate change. We want action on the finance side. We want, on that disclosure, companies doing that disclosure, we want that to become the norm.
Former Nissan chief Carlos Ghosn has fled to Lebanon from Japan, where he faced charges of financial wrongdoing and was expected to stand trial in 2020. In a statement, Ghosn said, quote, "I have not fled justice. I've escaped injustice and political persecution," unquote. It's unclear how the former executive was able to leave Japan after being forced to surrender his passports. Ghosn has Lebanese citizenship, and Lebanon does not have an extradition pact with Japan. In New York, the city's agreed to pay $12.5 million to settle a class action lawsuit with people who are subjected to invasive strip searches while visiting family members and loved ones in jails in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Rikers Island. Many of the women reported being penetrated by female guards or forced to drop their pants and show their sanitary napkins. The settlement marks the first time New York will pay damages to visitors of jails who've long raised concerns about the invasive and humiliating strip searches. The family of a teenager who died in 2017 after a Michigan state trooper stunned him with a taser has reached a $12 million settlement with the Michigan State Police. 15-year-old Damon Grimes was riding an ATV in a residential area of Detroit when a police officer tased him for not pulling over fast enough. The teen then crashed into the back of a parked truck and died quickly after. This is the Michigan State Police Department's largest ever settlement for a single incident. A lawyer for the Grimes family said, quote, "We hope this kind of money will act as a deterrent, but unfortunately, it rarely does." A Colorado judge has ordered the Denver Police Department to stop enforcing the city's ban against camping, saying the ban amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. Several homeless rights organizations in Colorado celebrated the decision, which comes 2 weeks after the Supreme Court also upheld protections for people who sleep or camp outdoors by leaving in place a lower court ruling saying it was unconstitutional for cities to prosecute people for sleeping or camping outside unless the city provides shelter for every single unhoused person in their jurisdiction. Prominent progressive journalist and editor William Grider has died. Grider spent decades reporting on politics, economics, civil rights, and labor issues for The Washington Post, Rolling Stone magazine, and The Nation. The award-winning journalist died on Christmas Day at his home in Washington, D.C. at the age of 83. And here in New York, longtime WBAI producer and journalist Dred Scott Keyes has also died. He won multiple awards from the National Federation of Community Broadcasters for his radio documentaries, The Gospel Truth, The Sam Cooke Story, Sweet Soul Music, The Roots of Southern Soul Music, and Malcolm X speaks to the Midnight Ravers. Dred Scott Keyes also mixed and engineered the George Polk Award-winning documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. You can see that documentary at democracynow.org. At WBAI Pacifica Radio, he was known for mentoring fellow journalists and producers. Dred Scott Keyes died December 18th at the age of 68. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. Federal prosecutors have filed hate crime charges against the man accused of stabbing five Jewish worshipers with a machete during a Hanukkah celebration at a rabbi's home in a heavily ultra-Orthodox New York suburb of Muncie. They say the suspect, Grafton Thomas, kept journals that had references to Adolf Hitler, Nazi culture, and a drawing of a swastika. Officials said Grafton's cell phone showed multiple online searches for, quote, why did Hitler hate the Jews? His family and lawyers say he was mentally ill. This is attorney Michael Sussman.
My impression from speaking with him is that he needs serious psychiatric evaluation, and that is the primary focus. I don't know whether those who are making these charges have spent a moment speaking with him or relating to him, but my impression from what I have read in my conversation with him is that there are severe psychiatric issues.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has called the attack domestic terrorism, and several Jewish elected officials in New York have asked him to declare a state of emergency and to deploy the National Guard to visibly patrol and protect Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods. This is New York's 13th anti-Semitic incident in 3 weeks and follows a shooting at a kosher supermarket in Jersey City, New Jersey, in which two assailants killed three people before police shot them dead after an hours-long shootout. This comes as a new Associated Press database counts more mass killings in 2019 than any year dating back to at least the 1970s. These recent attacks have renewed calls for increased security and the right to be armed in places of worship. For more, we're joined here in New York by Audrey Sasson, Executive Director of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. Also with us via video stream is reporter Alex Yablon. He formerly wrote for The Trace, a news outlet that covers America's gun violence crisis. His recent analysis for Jewish Currents is headlined Contextualizing the Jersey City Shooting, and his article for Slate is How to Neutralize a Militia. Nearly every state has the legal tools to crack down on paramilitaries. Why don't they use them? We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Audrey, let's begin with you. Your reaction to what took place in Muncie against the Hasidic community there?
So clearly we're outraged and devastated, and the Jewish community as a whole is both in mourning and scared. And so that's very real. What is really powerful about how our community is also responding right now is that we believe that the answers to what is happening is not more policing necessarily, or not policing as the only response. And so our focus is to build solidarity with other groups targeted by anti-Semitism. So anti-Semitism is on the rise. It is in the water. It is being fueled by white nationalist administration. And it is in the water, and it is everywhere, and it is causing a rise in hate crimes across the board. The way it shows up against Jews is different than the way it shows up against other communities, but all communities are targeted by white supremacy and white nationalism. And so our response is to come together with other communities that are targeted.
How is it different when you explained how it's expressed?
Yes, it's different in, you know, simply put, it's different in that anti-Semitism is a tool that punches up against Jews, in that it portrays Jews as and positions Jews as powerful, whereas a lot of the other oppressions that we're used to sort of learning about and teaching about and interrupting punch down. That's a sort of like shorthand for saying that it deems those communities as inferior, mostly Black and brown communities, and that white supremacy sort of and capitalism together are interlocked in a way that needs both of these oppressions to happen simultaneously, so that when oppression against marginalized communities, Black and brown and immigrant communities is happening, they leave that sort of anti-Semitism is used as a lever to shift blame onto Jews as scapegoats, and so they're portrayed as powerful, and then anger, rightful anger about real problems are unleashed against Jews, as opposed to the real sort of sources of those of the oppression that people are struggling with.
So you were a part of and helped to lead a major protest this weekend,
yes.
A multicultural protest. Explain who was there.
Yes, it was, I would even maybe dare to call it not so much a protest as a ritual gathering, a public, a sort of defiant public gathering of Jews of all backgrounds, secular and ultra-Orthodox, Haredi and Chabad Jews alongside Jews who maybe observe once a year, and our allies, Muslim allies who showed up in force, and other POC community allies and leaders that we have worked with as an organization. J-Fridge has worked across the board with grassroots groups across the city that came to show their solidarity and support. And so we went to Grand Army Plaza on the eighth night of Hanukkah to mark the closing of this holiday that has been marked by so much violence with an evening of public ritual. Hundreds of people gathered within hours of a call to mobilization, and they came out to say, we are here, we're not going to go underground, we're going to stand in solidarity with other targeted communities, and that's what's going to keep us safe.
So African Americans, Muslims, many people joined you.
Immigrant, Muslim, and African American. And from a lot of grassroots organizations that do a lot of this work with us as well.
Alex Yablon, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. This is New York's, it's estimated, 13th anti-Semitic incident in 3 weeks, following a shooting at a kosher supermarket in Jersey City in which two assailants killed three people before police shot them dead in an hours-long shootout. You wrote specifically about this and talking about contextualizing this. Respond to this latest attack before we also then talk about Texas and this new report out that hate crimes are up this year higher than in any time in half a century.
Sure. So what I see the two recent attacks on ultra-Orthodox Jews having in common is that, they both seem to have been committed by fairly isolated, disturbed people. There's not an indication like there is, like we've seen in more explicitly white nationalist anti-Semitic attacks like the Poway synagogue shooting in California or the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting in 2018, that these people, the perpetrators were enmeshed in, networks, an online subculture of really fleshed out anti-Semitism that valorized acts of mass violence like this. In both cases, these appear to be people, in both the Jersey City case and the Muncie case, the incidents appear to have been carried out by people who seem to have been, for lack of a better word, self-radicalized, not necessarily part of a movement that advocates this kind of behavior. That stands in stark contrast to the white power movement, which has a kind of a playbook for carrying out these kinds of attacks.
I wanted to go to Texas, the man who shot and killed two people at Sunday services at a church in the town called White Settlement, has been identified as Teeth Thomas Kinnunen, and he had a criminal past dating back more than a decade, including arrest for assault, battery, theft. His victims identified as Anton Wallace and Richard White. The shooter was killed by an armed parishioner. A pair of state laws adopted since 2017 authorize armed security details at houses of worship and also allow parishioners to bring their own licensed concealed weapons to church. This is Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton speaking Monday on Fox News.
This church was prepared, and they are an example of what can be done. And within 6 seconds, they dealt with the issue and saved potentially hundreds of people. I hope that other churches around the country will adopt policies like this, and we can stop losing so many people when these incidences occur.
So, Alex Yablon, if you can respond to this and the AP report, this new database that's being compiled, that's showing hate crimes increase this year more than any time in half a century.
Sure. So it's certainly true that this shooting in Texas could have been much worse if people did not respond so quickly with deadly force. And I don't want to denigrate the quick thinking or the courage of the parishioners who responded. But, you know, it has to be said that, you know, that's the sort of the end of a long line of sort of policy failures. The fact that the suspect in the Texas church shooting was able to get a gun at all is outrageous. He had a really extensive list of violent criminal history. He had been accused in a filing for a restraining order by his ex-wife of really disturbing behavior, frequent arsons, and emotional abuse of his son, who lived in terror of him. And yet he was able to get a shotgun. And, you know, that's the burden that is placed on the parishioners, who have to come into church armed, or believe they have to come into church armed and respond in this way. They only have to do that because they live in a state where the flow of weapons is so poorly controlled. You know, it's sort of like praising, you know, I tweeted that it's sort of like a slumlord in the 1970s South Bronx praising the firefighters. You know, yes, they're behaving heroically, but why do they have to respond to these horrible incidents in the first place?
I wanted to clarify this AP database. This new Associated Press database counts more mass killings in 2019 than any year dating back to at least the 1970s. Audrey Sasson, if you can also respond to this issue and how you feel hate crimes need to be dealt with today. And in the case of the Monsey attack, the machete attack on the Jewish worshipers, the lawyer for the alleged attacker says that he is mentally ill, that he suffers from schizophrenia.
Yes, I think that we have to look at hate crimes in a very holistic and comprehensive way. People who might be suffering from mental illness, in living in a society in which anti-Semitism and racism and all of these oppressions are mixed in, that is a dangerous combination. You know, clearly, we're seeing it now because anti-Semitism has risen to the surface with the sort of bigoted rhetoric coming out of the highest offices of the land, giving permission, in a sense, to those who might be unstable to unleash. And so with our approach and the approach of grassroots community organizations to hate crimes is actually to think about what our preventive and restorative and repair approaches. So we're part of this coalition of grassroots groups, 9 groups across the city representing all targeted communities, Muslim, Jewish, LGBT, and beyond, who are seeking together a way to decriminalize, sort of to reduce our reliance on police, which right now is the only answer. And I think, like Alex was saying, what is the source of the issue? So, you know, if you ask someone, of course, everyone wants to be safe. We all need to be safe, and we all need to be able to not have to look over our shoulders. That is everyone's right. Black communities, Jewish communities, Black Jewish communities, where this overlaps. And so bringing more police into communities of color where there are also, you know, largely more white Jews living alongside Black people is going to over-criminalize that community. And we think that that will actually reduce our security and our safety. So for hate violence, the Hate Violence Prevention Initiative is looking to think about hate crimes from the perspective of what is the root of it and how do we bring teshuva, which is a Jewish term of repair, so in enacting more restorative justice, more community control, and bringing a whole other lens to hate violence. We don't want to increase the punishment. We want to actually change the paradigm in which we think about it.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. I want to thank Audrey Sasson, who is the Executive Director of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, JFRIJ, and Alex Yablon, who reports on guns, extremism, and mass shootings. When we come back, media legend Pat Mitchell on becoming a dangerous woman, as she talks about leading activists and artists and political figures from Mary Robinson to Ava DuVernay to Ai-Jen Poo. Stay with us. music by Philip Glass. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we end our last show of 2019 with media legend Pat Mitchell, a woman of many firsts. She was the first woman president of PBS, CNN Productions, the Paley Center for Media, chair of the Sundance Institute and the Women's Media Center. She tells her story in her new book, Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World. We spoke to her last week about her own life story. Today, she talks about some of the 15 women she chose to feature.
I learned so much in listening to them talk about their own journeys because they're so vastly different. I mean, you talk to an Ava DuVernay who so brilliantly and beautifully describes that being dangerous to her means reaching out to one another and protecting each other, creating safe spaces for each other, healing each other. Beautiful language from a film director. And then Mary Robinson, who has been dangerous her whole life, but who says very clearly, I didn't always call myself dangerous because being president of a country, I avoided the word. But she goes on to say, I didn't ask for forgiveness ever or permission ever. I just did what I thought was right. Well, that's an act of fearlessness. And Mary is someone I'm working with now on the climate crisis and her climate justice work.
Let me go right now to the Irish president, to Mary Robinson, who served as president from 1990 to 1997 and UN High Commissioner for Human Rights from 97 to 2002. She's now the president of the Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice. Shortly after Donald Trump was elected president, Democracy Now! Spoke with Mary Robinson at the UN Climate Summit in Marrakesh, Morocco. And I asked her what it would mean for the United States. Well, this was before he did it, before he became president, but had just been elected, if Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Agreement.
The first thing is, I think it would damage the image and reputation of the United States globally, because the United States signed up to this important agreement, in fact, gave great leadership. Both President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry have given great leadership on climate, together with China and other major emitters, and were forceful in ensuring we got the agreement, and were willing to have the ambitious goal that is in the Paris Agreement. If one country were to renege now on that, I think it would damage that country's reputation internationally. How can you sign up to something that's so important for the world, that the world knows is real and happening, and then somehow because somebody is blind to or pretends to be blind to the consequences because of the lobbies that are surrounding him, I'm afraid that that just is not acceptable to the world.
That was in 2016 at the Morocco UN Climate Summit. We just came from Madrid, COP25. And you yourself, Pat Mitchell, are engaging in climate activism right now. You were just arrested with Jane Fonda and over 140 other people last Friday, protesting the climate crisis and where we stand today. But there you have Mary Robinson talking about what it means if the U.S. pulls out of the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump is doing, effective the day after Election Day 2020. Pat.
Mary was so right in the impact of that withdrawal. And yet she and women climate leaders all over the world are continuing to believe in the power of global agreements on how we respond to the climate crisis. And until, I think, Mary wrote in her own book on climate justice, not that many in the world recognized how critical the role of women leaders had been in getting us to climate agreements. It was in all of those climate summits before, the women leaders who, behind the scenes and out of the public eye, kept the negotiations moving forward all the way to the Paris Agreement. Women from all over the world getting past their differences and working to help others get past their differences. So even though we are in this really precarious place, a true state of emergency, and our president's response has only heightened the emergency and heightened the amount of rage felt in the world against our country for losing our leadership position here, I have experienced and seen women stepping up to leadership in this one particular area so critical, the existential threat to our existence on this planet. Mary and the women like her who are stepping up to leadership are not letting this climate justice work end. And they will continue to lead toward those global agreements and have a particular ability to negotiate and to keep people at the negotiating table. That's her goal now.
I was also particularly interested with Chapter 7, Going Global, where you highlight two women, a Palestinian leader, Hanan Ashrawi, and her dear friend and an Israeli leader, actually a human rights attorney, Leah Tzemel. They were featured in a film recently by Rachel Leah Jones called The Advocate. This is Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, followed by Leah Tzemel.
And I was arrested. I was looking for a lawyer. And from that day on, I mean, Leah was really part of our experience of struggle at Birzeit University during, you know, all these closures, during all these military incursions, the shootings, the arrests, and so on. It was Leah who was there all the time. To us, being a prisoner, it's a fact of life. Every home, every family has had at least one prisoner, if not more. Many families have had martyrs. Many families have had people, you know, deported. Many families have had their homes destroyed. But every family can tell you, I have prisoners in my midst. The Israelis reached into my home and extracted my son, my daughter, my husband, my brother, and took him or her away. And it was Leah who was there saying, I will try to bring him or her back. Leah went to court to help our students. And I was nursing, I was breastfeeding Zaina, and Talila got hungry, so I breastfed her as well. And so now we have their milk sisters. It's in our tradition when two babies are fed the same mother's milk, they become sisters. And this is a very strong bond.
I really don't feel the gap of a Palestinian, a Jew. I don't think we ever had it between us.
She was very human. She was the only one really who recognized this in the Greek sense of anagnorisis. You know, I recognize your humanity and what you're going through. If you are fighting against injustice and you don't have any other tools, you adopt the tools that are available. You manufacture your own tools. Some people turn their bodies into tools. They don't have, you know, warplanes, they don't have tanks, they have bodies. And it doesn't mean she condoned this or she thought it was right, but she said you have to understand it in the context within which this happened. This is a very difficult and rare situation, where you could look at the victim come violent person and understand the motives for violence and understand that this is a response to a greater form of violence. You are not abstract, labeled terrorists.
That's Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, the longtime Palestinian diplomat and scholar, along with the human rights lawyer Leah Tzemel from Rachel Leah Jones' film The Advocate. Pat Mitchell, you write about them both in your book, Becoming a Dangerous Woman. Talk about why you feature this Palestinian woman and this Israeli Jew.
Those two extraordinary women leaders were part of a series I did quite a long time ago, Amy, called Women in War, Voices from the Front Lines. And that I found on the front lines in the Middle East, in Northern Ireland, in El Salvador during the wars. I found women who were bridging their political differences, coming from different sides of these long-term conflicts and finding ways to shape solutions to end the violence in their communities. That's where I first met Mary Robinson, actually, was during the Northern Ireland Troubles. And in the Middle East, in Israel and in Palestine, I met Hanan and Leah and became a part of their group, which included women from both sides of that long-term conflict, secretly meeting, secretly making the kinds of arrangements to lead their communities to more peaceful solutions. And I recognized in particular the friendship between Hanan and Leah was a model for how women can move the world forward toward more peaceful negotiations. And it's not just a pipe dream. It's actually been proven that when women are at peace tables, the peace agreements they help negotiate last longer because they bring in all of the other elements that women are concerned about, healthcare, education, the sustainable factors of a community. And when those are considered in peace agreements, they last longer. Now, Hanan and Leah are still in conflict zones, certainly, but they are still friends. Their daughters grew up together as friends. And for me, that models the new way forward. It models for me what Bella Abzug predicted out of that conflict when the women convened the first ever all-women's peace conference in 1989. Bella said, in the 21st century, women will change the nature of power rather than power changing the nature of women. And that is what Leah and Hanan represent in that world, and that's what Mary Robinson represented in her leadership. And the same thing I witnessed with women in El Salvador, who also brought the rebel armies and the government together to negotiate the end of that civil war. And it is that ability of women to negotiate, to compromise, to collaborate, to align values in a different way that I believe will lead the world forward to a more just and equitable place.
Pat Mitchell, let's turn to another of the dangerous women you include in your book, the acclaimed director Ava DuVernay. At the Sundance Film Festival a few years ago, I spoke to Ava about Hollywood's lack of diversity.
The obstacle is systemic. It's systemic. It's a system that's been set up in a certain way. Times have changed. Ideas have matured. And the system might not have caught up with that or stayed up with that. But you have very conscious people, very, you know, liberal people, very progressive people within the Academy. I'm a member. I was invited a couple of years ago. My black cinematographer, Bradford Young, was invited this year. There's an attempt, but, you know, like I said, it needs to be articulated and followed up on. I think the thing that is challenging is when people talk about it should happen, but then there's no follow-up to that.
Talk about, Pat Mitchell, why you included Ava DuVernay, who's broken through so many barriers in Hollywood.
I think Ava individually has done so much to make Hollywood a more inclusive place. Through her nonprofit Array, she has made sure that films by communities of color get distributed. She has brought women and other people from other communities, often who face additional barriers to getting projects made, stories told. She's made that a priority, and she's walked the talk. She's done it. I mean, you look at the project she's taken on herself, and then you look at the people she hires. In the series she did on television, she hired women directors to do every single episode. Now, that took fighting through some barriers, systemic barriers, as Ava herself indicates. But she's done it. So including Ava was very important to me because she is a representative of how important representation is in media, on all our screens, behind and in front of the cameras, ensuring that all stories are getting told, all voices are being heard and respected. Ava's a leader there, and so is the Sundance Institute, which I'm very privileged to chair that board. Inclusiveness in our festival, in the people who are behind the scenes, who are directing, who are writing the stories, making sure that that is a more inclusive and representative world has been a strategic priority of the Institute. And Ava served on that board and was a leader and making this a priority for all of us.
Media legend Pat Mitchell, her book, Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World, an update. The documentary I mentioned during our interview called Advocate has been shortlisted for an Academy Award. I'll be moderating a Q&A in New York with the filmmaker Rachel Leah Jones this Friday at 7 after the film shows at the Quad Cinema. Back with Pat Mitchell and Becoming a Dangerous Woman in a minute. Here by Slater Kinney. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue my conversation with media legend Pat Mitchell, who tells her story and many more in her new book, Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World. Another one of the 15 dangerous women she features in her book is the filmmaker, activist, and wealthy Disney heiress, Abigail Disney. This year, Abigail Disney wrote an op-ed for The Washington Post headlined, "It's time to call out Disney and anyone else rich off their workers' backs." In July, Abigail Disney spoke to Democracy Now! About what she hoped to accomplish.
I've been hoping to take the wage issue on by way of Disney, because it's such a stark and clear problem that in the same year, at the same company, you have one employee who comes home with $140 million and another employee that goes home for a full day's work and doesn't have enough money to pay for their insulin. It's in the same year of record profitability at the same company. And frankly, they're less than 30 miles from each other. This should trouble us all. This cannot be abided. So there's first of all, a practical reason not to be doing these things, but also there's a moral question. And that's the one I think we need to take on. We cannot continue to just look the other way as one class of people gets wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And if you make $140 million in a year, I ask you, what can you not afford? How can you possibly use that money? And how can you sleep at night given what's happening at the other end?
So that's Abby Disney. Pat Mitchell, she's calling out her own industry. In fact, her own family, and her activism has only escalated since we last spoke to her.
Abby is a great example of one of the features of becoming more dangerous, and that is that you have to care less what others think and say more clearly what we think and feel. And Abby's one of the best examples of that in the world. She's always been brave, and she's always taken risk, both in the work she has done, her documentaries, and in her leadership, this kind of leadership, on the issue of wage, equal pay for equal work. I admire Abby so much, and it takes somebody like Abby who will step forward and say exactly what she thinks and not care about what the consequences are, and to fight for the different kinds of consequences for the people she's fighting for in this case.
I wanted to turn now to another of the dangerous women you feature, Christine Schuller-Describer, the director of V-Day Congo, co-founder of Director of City of Joy, revolutionary community for women survivors of gender violence in Bukavu in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We spoke to her last year as the worldwide movement called V-Day to stop violence against women and girls marked its 20th anniversary, and I asked her about the City of Joy, that community that she and Eve Ensler helped establish.
The women are survivors. Well, we said gender violence survivors, but at the end, they are all survivors of rape. And it's a center where we train women in leadership. And half of the program is therapy. And I think at the end, they spend 6 months at City of Joy, and then they go back into their community. And then they organize themselves, you know, in a network. And they are all partner of V-Day now, to also recruit women to come at City of Joy, and they spread the message. Everything they learn at City of Joy, they spread it in their community.
That's Christine Schuler, describer, director of V-Day Congo. You're deeply involved with that movement, have been a longtime supporter of V-Day, founded by Eve Ensler. And you yourself are a survivor of sexual abuse, as we talked about in the first segment of our conversation today. Talk about the power you derive from coming out, from joining with other women, whether we're talking about the United States or the DRC.
It's enormous, the power of community. And I experience it maybe most profoundly when I'm at City of Joy in the DRC with Christine and the women survivors at City of Joy. Christine is the best example of someone who lives with danger every day and who knew she had to become more dangerous herself, braver and bolder, to help end a war that's being waged on women's bodies, quite literally, and to take a different approach to healing with survivors by training those survivors. Christine and Eve call it transforming pain to power, and training these survivors to go back into their villages and communities as leaders. Because we know the power is there in the communities that we are building. And Jane Fonda said a wonderful thing too about that, something that Christine and Eve and I believe so strongly, that if you're feeling depressed and despairing about the world, and if you spend any time in Eastern Congo, you can certainly feel despair. The best way to address that is to become a part of an activism community. That not only relieves the feeling of despair by replacing it with the feeling that you're doing something, you're addressing a challenge, you're facing a challenge, and you're solving it. And one, however small or insignificant it may feel, it is significant. City of Joy has turned out over 1,000 of those survivors back into their communities now as leaders. And that will begin to change the situation and the DRC. So seeing that, the most dire of circumstances and dangers, and seeing those women become more dangerous to face those challenges and to build community, that's our way forward.
Finally, I wanted to turn to yet another of the women you feature in the book, Ai-Jen Poo, the executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and the co-director of Caring Across Generations. We spoke with her last year shortly after Donald Trump characterized countries in Africa, as well as El Salvador and Haiti, as, well, we know, the S-hole countries. This was Ai-Jen Poo's response.
I was not surprised, but I also want to say that this is not normal, and we cannot normalize this. This level of racism that is emboldening white supremacists all over the country to target people in our communities, people who work in our homes, caring for some of the most precious elements of our lives, our children, our aging parents. I mean, undocumented immigrants, the people that he is targeting are people who are so deeply embedded in the fabric of this country, people who are leaders in the community like Ravi, and they're being targeted, and people who are targeting them in an inhumane way are being emboldened in this moment, and we cannot normalize it.
That's Ai-Jen Poo, the executive director for National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations, who you feature in your book, Pat Mitchell, Becoming a Dangerous Woman, particularly in these, to say the least, very dangerous times for so many. Interestingly, President Trump was impeached on International Migrants Day. That was December 18th. But if you can talk about Ai-Jen's bravery, her organizing prowess, and what it means to organize in an era of Trump.
Well, it's no coincidence that there has been, along with President Trump's election and the polarizing of this country, a rise in racism, sexism, violence against women. That's not a coincidence. And what Ai-Jen has called for many, many times over the last couple of years has been what she describes as almost a sunstorm, a beautiful allegorical way of thinking about all of these communities, these caring communities who do make it possible for all the rest of us to go forward. Because what has declined, at the same time all of those horrific things have risen, what has declined has been empathy and compassion. And those around those two ideas of the empathy we feel for people who are not living our lives but who are in our communities, and the compassion and caring we feel for each other, that's core to any society's sustainability. And Ai-Jen is organized around those principles across many different occupations, many different generations. And in doing so, I believe she's called on us to be our very best selves. And what gets me up every morning, and I think what certainly continues to motivate Ai-Jen and all the other remarkable women that I am privileged to know and to work alongside, is the belief that in this country and around the world, it will be our empathy, it will be our caring for each other, it will be our compassion for each other's suffering that will lead us to find ways to bridge our differences, heal our divides, and move forward as a community, a country, and a world.
And finally, Pat, the issue of you breaking through so many glass ceilings, I thought it was very interesting how you talked about the discomfort you feel that you are the first in so many cases, that it doesn't, that it is such a problem that so few women rise to levels of power in their fields because of discrimination. You are the first woman president of PBS, the first woman president of CNN Productions, the Paley Center for Media. If we could end by talking about PBS and what that meant when you were tapped to head the public broadcasting service in this country.
Being the first or the only person in any situation that looks like you is always an additional challenge because there is a harsher spotlight. And for women leaders, it's always meant a fear of being judged entirely as a woman leader, and yet, in my case, wanting to lead for women. And as president of PBS, in a particularly tumultuous time for public media, although nearly every time has been tumultuous in that there are always threats to the existence of public funding for public media, which is so essential to a free and open society and to this democracy. I was certainly judged in a different way. It's the same thing that happens to women running for office or to any person who is in a position for the first time. So, yes, I faced challenges, but I tried to respond affirmatively. I was accused once of actually running an affirmative action program at PBS because I was seeking to hire women of color, women, people who were qualified but who had not been on those lists that search firms bring you when you have open positions or when you're looking to promote. And just asking that those lists be more inclusive is an affirmative action that I think made a difference at PBS. The best news here, Amy, is that in all three of those positions where I was a first, I was not the last. In each of those positions, there are now women CEOs.
and President Trump calling the media the enemy of the American people?
Well, it says everything, doesn't it, about the way he views free and open society? Because if you don't have access to free or to open and trustworthy information, how can we as citizens make any decisions about anything, but most particularly how we vote? The leaders in our communities, states, and in our country. So the press, a free, trusted press, is absolutely essential to a democracy. We've always known that, and now we have a threat to that in a way that probably hasn't existed before. And yes, it causes fear, but I'm trying to respond to it by being more fearless and speaking up all the more for the kind of work that you and democracy now do, Amy.
Pat Mitchell, author of Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World. She's former first woman president of PBS and chair of the Sundance Institute. Go to democracynow.org for part one of our interview, where she talks about her own life story and describes her arrest in Washington, D.C. earlier this month with Jane Fonda and more than 140 other people in a climate protest, Fire Drill Fridays. Oh, and tune in to our New Year's Day special Wednesday. 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed women the right to vote. We begin the new decade with an hour-long special about one of the most influential women in U.S. politics, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. After the death of her husband, President Franklin Roosevelt, she spearheaded the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights. President Truman called her the First Lady of the World. And that does it for our show. Happy birthday, Chuck Skirich. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriana Contreras, and Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Happy, safe, and better New Year.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
And dolls, you are at the Malt Shop with Daddy G. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror. Grab your favorite squeeze and head on down to the Malt Shop, where the jukebox is playing. The kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. About a girl that I once knew. She took my love, then ran around with every single guy in town.